Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hey, everybody. Bienvenidos, bienvenidas. Welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies. This is Pamela Fuentes, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to David Carballo about his new book, Collision of Worlds, A Deep History of the Fall of Aztec Mexico and the Forming of New Spain, published by Oxford University Press this year. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pamela. It's wonderful to be here. And hello to everyone out there in podcast landia.
David, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm at Boston University, where I'm an associate professor of archaeology, anthropology, and Latin American studies. And my primary work is as an archaeologist in Mexico, in the working on the pre-Hispanic era, primarily, though, everywhere you look, of course, in central Mexico, there are the remains of colonial structures and the massive transformation of society that is the focal point of this particular book. Some combination of working in central Mexico for the last 20 plus years, and particularly working in the state of Tlaxcala for about 10 of those years, had me thinking about this momentous encounter, and in particular, the role of the Tlaxcalteca as these key allies of Cortes and the Spaniards, and that sort of tumultuous history, the fraught history of the Tlaxcalteca, of Malinche, of, as you know well, like to be the Malinchista, or to be thought of as a traitor in certain ways, that how it resonates in contemporary culture as well. Primarily my focus has been on in Tlaxcala and at Teotihuacan, the large pre-Aztec city just north of Mexico City, focused on all sorts of issues of community organization, household organization, just social life in the pre-Hispanic era.
Thank you. And now, can you tell us the story behind, your personal story behind writing Collision of Worlds? Why did you write this book? I just want to tell the audience that the language is very engaging, and I think it might be intended for broader audiences, but I would like you to tell us more about it.
Yeah, this really has been a labor of love in some ways, and getting back to issues that first interested me when I started out in archaeology. So as an undergraduate, when I discovered archaeology and pre-Hispanic Mesoamerica as a topic of study, this is, in the early to mid-1990s, there were a couple books then that were pretty formative in my thinking about these issues. That includes Hugh Thomas, who is a historian, a lot of about the Spanish world, he wrote a book on the conquest at that time, and then also the Mexican author Carlos Fuentes, who wrote a book called The Buried Mirror, which was commemorating the quincentennial of Columbus. So this was for 1992. And thinking about transatlantic history, thinking about these deep connections between Iberia and Mesoamerica. And so part of that is also my own personal history as being having a transatlantic family. So my abuelos came from Spain during the Spanish Civil War. They were fleeing Franco and the dictatorship there, and they came to Cuba and actually got married there and lived there for a couple of years before then migrating to New York. And some of their brothers and sisters stayed in Spain. Others came to Cuba and then went on to Venezuela and Uruguay and some to Florida. And so I have this diaspora transatlantic family myself and have always just been interested in these transatlantic connections.
And in the preface of the book, you explain, and I mean, this is a logic following your background in archaeology, but you explain that the book focuses on material things and the co-creative actions of Mesoamerican and Spaniards. The story you wrote, you tell us, consider mute objects and places of the past that act simultaneously with written narratives of witness or those that heard about those narratives. How did the sources you used complement each other?
Yeah, so as an archaeologist, I realized that my role, my lens in this, you know, complex retelling of these events of 500 years ago would be more valuable if I sort of emphasized how I see things, which are involve temporal change over long periods of time, centuries or millennia, and also the material record, what we call sites and artifacts in archaeology, the stuff people made, where they used it, their their ancient cities, and the fact that there's many centuries of history, like you know well, being from Mexico and knowing how many sites are just testament in a very profound and material way to centuries of history, right? So, for instance, if you go to a place like Tlatelolco, where you can see the Plaza de las Tres Culturas, and you can see the remains of the Aztec pre-Hispanic levels, and on top of them, the colonial level of a Franciscan church, and behind them, contemporary 20th century, 21st century architecture. So that idea of a palimpsest history in a particular site, in spaces, in the built environment has always been very appealing to me. And one of the ways that I sort of navigate the world when I'm traveling or doing research is thinking about those connections and those layers of history.
Your first chapter opens the door to the history of the meeting of two worlds. And those two worlds were separated for centuries, and of course they own have had their own social cultural development. In order to start understanding these elements for each of these two worlds, you introduced two towns, Cholula in Mexico and Medellin in Spain. And you call them the points of entry of this encounter. Why these two towns? What are they telling us about this story?
Yeah, I wanted to start with Cholula and Medellin because they have some similarities in being places where there's this layered history, where you can see millennia of pre-Hispanic Mexican intercolonial occupation in Cholula, and then Iberian history in the case of Medellin. Both of them have prominent hills on the landscape that anchor this history. And in the case of Cholula, it's what the post-classic occupants, the Choluteca, called the Tlachihualtepet, which means the human-made, man-made mountain, which of course isn't actually a mountain, it's a buried pyramid. And it's by some accounts the largest pyramid ever erected in terms of total volume in the world. And it has multiple construction phases through a 700-year or so history of occupation. And then it fell into disuse by time the post-classic period where the Choluteca continued with a new center of their city. If you go to Cholula today, where there's the monastery of San Gabriel in the center of town, that was where the pyramid to Quetzalcoatl during the Aztec period was erected, and that was dismantled by Cortez. But on top of the Tlachihualtepetl, or the Great Pyramid of Cholula, the Spaniards also flattened that and put a church. First, there was just a cross, and then eventually a church. And so you see this colonial-era church on top of it as well. So you can really see those layers of superimposed history. And likewise, in Medellin, of course, was the hometown of Cortez. And so it connects directly to Cholula as a place where Cortez ordered this massacre in Cholula's sacred precinct. And it's one of the pivotal events in the narrative of the actual Aztec-Spanish War. And there in Medellin, there is a natural hill, but it was heavily modified by human activities. And so you can see a Roman theater on one side, and you can see actually Islamic period water cisterns in the top of the hill, and a castle from the medieval period up on top as well, and even the church where Cortez was baptized. It's the Iglesia de San Martin, and under that was a Roman temple. And so I just love the fact that there's this, the deep roots of cultures in both areas that are also then two towns that are inextricably linked through the events of 500 years ago when Cortez ordered that massacre in Cholula.
The second and third chapters present a deep history of Mesoamerica and Iberia. Both are rich in details regarding the people and environment of the region. Let's start with the chapter that talks about Mesoamerica. As I mentioned, they have a lot of details. I would like us to focus on two particular elements that will play a central role in the story that you developed in your book. First is the idea or the micro-patriotism that existed in Mesoamerica, and also the variety of languages spoken there and the variety that the society had in there.
Yeah, so the idea of micropatriotism comes out of researchers such as James Lockhart and his students like Matthew Restall, who've written quite a bit of new conquest history, updating over the last few decades earlier narratives about the conquest. And something they've pointed out is that the affiliation, there's no sort of singular Aztec perspective on the conquest, or Maya perspective on the conquest, because the people that we use those terms for really associated as different ethnic groups and very closely with their city-state, which in Nahuatl, the Aztec language, is the Altepetl. And so that was really your primary affiliation in Mesoamerica is to city-state. And because of that, there wasn't this overall sense of us versus them when these foreigners from Spain and other places arrived on the shores of Veracruz. That particular landscape was full of not just different city states, but different ethno-linguistic groups, people speaking different languages that are quite diverse. So just as an example, starting in the Yucatan Peninsula, that's the region of the Maya, and there's not just one Mayan language. There's over 30 of them, and they're roughly as related to one another as Romance languages are. And so the fact that there'd be Yucatec Mayan speakers, in the northern peninsula, and then heading westward through the Gulf of Mexico, there was the Chontal Maya. These were important groups because they're the ones the Spaniards first encountered and then became translators. Most importantly, the woman known as Malinche or Malintzli, who spoke both these languages as well as Nahuatl, which was the dominant language of the Aztec Empire, the lingua franca. And so language really played this key role in mediating the encounter and conquest or invasion. And I really wanted to trace those roots back. So why was it that there was this sort of somewhat balkanized political landscape, such linguistic diversity in Mesoamerica, and looking that again in, through deep time, and we can come back to earlier chapters of Mesoamerican history, like where I do a lot of my research at Teotihuacan. That was really a polyglot city. It was a city where multiple languages were spoken. There were ethnic enclaves of Zapotec speakers from Oaxaca, and we know that there were some Maya groups there, and some from West Mexico, probably around Michoacan, some from the Gulf of Mexico. So you know, Central Mexico had been the crossroads for millennia, and I want to trace that history back so the reader can understand the broader context of what happens starting in 1519.
And now going to the other scenario of this story. In the chapter titled Iberia, a Deep History, you open with an epigraph, and just warning, probably it's not going to be the only epigraph I'm going to bring to the conversation because they were all in point. But this epigraph reads, Spain, which was to play so great a part in the discovery and colonization of the New World, was once discovered and colonized itself. Can you tell us more about this part of Spanish history?
Yeah, so that was a historian, J.B. Trend, who wrote that. And I thought it was fascinating because so much of charting Iberia's deep history has to do with these waves of invasions that the peninsula faced. And so in some cases, they were more peaceable. Like, so for instance, first, there were earlier migrations during period of early agriculture and the development of Bronze Age society. But, the first real consequential colonizers that I refer to are the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians, of course, came from the Eastern Mediterranean, and they sailed all the way across the Mediterranean Sea and into the Atlantic. And that starts this naval history that Iberia is known for. So, if you were just to start with the question, why did Iberians cross the Atlantic and colonize and not American societies crossing eastward to colonize Europe? Some of that has to do with naval history and navigation and really going back to the Phoenician period is the start of it. Obviously, it's much more complex than that. But I like to frame the Iberian Peninsula as a hinge between two worlds, the Mediterranean and the Atlantic world. And the Phoenicians were sort of the first to do that by colonizing parts of southern Spain. After them are the Carthaginians, who, of course, were the descendants of Phoenicians themselves. They found their own colony in North Africa at Carthage. And they actually conquered parts of the southern peninsula. And then in wars with Rome, known as the Punic Wars, eventually lost control of Iberia, which then went to Rome. And so then there was centuries of Roman rule, which brought a lot of the infrastructure to Spain's urbanism. Most cities in Spain that you go to today have some Roman roots to them, as well as many roadways. And then, of course, once Rome collapsed, then you have the Goths. And after that, the Islamic invasion centuries of rule and the Reconquista. And so, it had been this a crossroads, but also a battleground for millennia. And I think that's part of framing the conquest of Mexico is sort of, an extension of these waves of conquest on the Iberian Peninsula, then eventually spilling over with the Reconquista into the Canary Islands and then into the Americas, into the Caribbean, and then into Mexico.
And then after you gave us all the basis to understand these two worlds separately in a long, in their long history, you write the chapter Mexico and Spain on the Eve of the Encounter. And in there you made this comparison of different sociopolitical aspects of Mesoamerica and Iberia just before their encounter in the 16th century. You compare several aspects: ethnic and national identity, cities, trade, economy, forms of government, etc. I would like to talk about two aspects, one more in depth, but before going to that one, there's a little piece of information you present that I'm curious about. And that is the role of women in the political organization, whether in Mesoamerica and Iberia.
Yeah, that was really interesting to read about. It wasn't something that I had, you know, thought of going into, you know, this particular comparison. I do, you know, as an undergrad, I studied political science. And so I think I've always been interested in comparative political systems as part of my work as an archaeologist in Mexico. But so, you know, something that I had noticed in Mesoamerica is you have certain societies or periods of time where societies are more organized with an emphasis on kinship and especially dynastic kinship. As an example, the classic period Maya society had an institution of divine kingship, and bloodlines mattered very much. They called their kings Ulahau, which means royal blood, lord. Other societies like the Mixtec of the post-classic period also really had strong bloodlines there. And so did Castilla or Castile in Spain, where the bloodlines mattered a lot, and royal bloodlines and purity of bloodlines. And in those societies, they might practice male preference primogeniture, meaning that the firstborn son would be the one who would have the right to rule or that title, but they would allow for female rulers. And so on the one hand, those societies can seem more autocratic and very much centralizing power, but at the same time, it allows for different gender roles or the possibility of female rulers. In other societies that tend to be more pluralistically organized, where say a noble council or a senate is responsible for electing the ruler, those, even though they can be more open and there can be more access for other families to install a ruler, they tend to always elect males. So there actually tends to be a blockage to female rulership. And we see that in some cases from central Mexico, including the Tenochca, the Mexica Tenochca, the dominant group from Tenochtitlan. And interestingly, in the Iberian Peninsula, that was true of Aragon, so the other main kingdom, which had a court structure and male rulership. Now, that's not to say there were instances in Aztec societies of female great speakers, but they were very rare. And so I think that was an interesting comparison, that in both areas you had a more kinship dynastic model, and then also a more sort of pluralistic senate or council society, and how gender intersected with that.
And there's a fascinating section of that chapter that is titled Technologies of Imperialism. In there you explain the different approaches to warfare the Spanish and the Aztecs had, and you also explain the technology each of them used, and related to that in the following chapter you talk about different conceptions about life, and you introduced the concept of human sacrifice and the role it played in war. So can you tell us about these different approaches to warfare and technology and ideas about life, warriors, etc.?
Yeah, so we, in say the Western world, or a tradition emphasizing the Mediterranean world and early civilizations of Eurasia, tends to focus a lot on technology. So I can say this as an archaeologist, and probably most listeners know that we talk about there being a Stone Age or Paleolithic, and then the Neolithic, when there's the agriculture, where there's new stone tools. And then you get the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. And so we sort of chart the passage of time very much through technology, and a very specific technology. It's sort of utilitarian or military weaponry and those sorts of implements, and they're prioritized in our long-term histories of the old world in particular. And that doesn't work for the Americas or the New World, where you get all sorts of technological innovation, but not so much in weapons or tools, where there was some bronze technologies in the Americas, in West Mexico in particular, and in the Andes. But there wasn't that sort of ramp up of technological change. And, you know, so sometimes you hear someone saying somewhat pejoratively that, you know, the Aztecs were like a Neolithic society, meaning that they used primarily stone tools. But on the other hand, you know, there's all sorts of technological innovations that, for instance, occurred first in Mesoamerica and not in Europe. Like, so the concept of zero that the Maya and other cultures had developed many centuries before it did in Europe. And so, you know, if we were to look at mathematics or astronomical knowledge, the fact that Mesoamericans, you know, for instance, knew that Venus was a single entity, it wasn't an evening star and a morning star, those sorts of astronomical observations that were very sophisticated early science, we could, you know, look at societies that way and how they differed. But in any case, our lens often in, you know, archaeology or the history of archaeology is tend to focus on these technological changes and a lot having to do with military technologies. And so in that case, yes, we can certainly see some differences. And this has to do with going back even to origins of agriculture in the two areas. So in Eurasia, where there was the domestication of large animals, most importantly for warfare, this would include horses, which were not domesticated in the Americas. There were few animals that lent themselves to domestication. So in the Andes, you have camelids like llamas and alpacas. But in Mesoamerica, you know, there are basically food animals, or there's domesticated dogs and turkeys, but there aren't large animals that would be ridden and then were part of a cavalry, for instance, in the case of warfare. Likewise, there wasn't that ramp up in metallurgy that would allow for iron and steel weapons. And old world warfare really was an arms race at a much more accelerated scale than you saw in Mesoamerica. In Mesoamerica, the technologies of offensive weapons and fortifications were relatively simple. There wasn't that arms race in the same way as you see in Eurasia. And related to that then was the ideas about when it is appropriate to kill and what's the morality behind killing, whether it's in the battlefield or elsewhere. And we have to understand Aztec human sacrifice within that context. And there were instances of sacrifice that did not have to do with warfare, but the vast majority did. The vast majority of sacrificial victims were prisoners of war. They were people who were caught in battle. And in fact, the entire objective of battles was generally to not kill people on the battlefield, rather to cripple them and bring them back to the temple for sacrifice. So the killing was done off of the battlefield. And as an Aztec warrior, you would only advance in rank. And this was, like in many parts of the world, one of the few forms of social mobility is to, you know, to become the highest in Aztec society would be an eagle warrior or a jaguar warrior. But there were other levels of military rank, and they had to do with the amount of captives you took for sacrifice. Killing people on the battlefield didn't count in this calculus. And so those differences were huge, and they really affected how the war between the Spaniards and Aztecs unfolded.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, following the path of your book, let's situate ourselves in the Mesoamerican coast, ready to see the expedition that would result in the invasion and eventual demise of the Aztec Empire. But before going there, I would like you to talk a little bit about several characters in this history. Some of them, the listeners might be more familiar with than others. But how would you introduce Hernando Cortés to this moment in this history? And if possible, trying to make a comparison with Gonzalo Guerrero, for instance, how those stories are different.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. So, yeah, Hernando Cortés, and as you know, he went by Hernando or Fernando in his lifetime. Hernan is a posthumous name for him. But so he came from Extremadura and Medellin, we already talked about, but Extremadura was a region, or is still a region of southwestern Spain that, you know, at the time of the Reconquista was very much the frontier. It was a militarized frontier with the Christian battles against Islamic forces in southern Spain. And because of that, it, you know, had its own sort of autonomy, like the way that the Reconquista unfolded. There was sort of this, you know, frontier general role and relatively small fighting forces in continual warfare against Islamic forces. And you know, Cortés came out of that environment. He was schooled at the University of Salamanca, which I do talk about a decent amount in the book because it's, you know, a fascinating place. You know, it was the institution of higher learning in Spain at the time. And but Cortés went to study law, which was a more vocational degree. He wanted to become a letrado, a person of letters, who would then work within the bureaucracy of emerging Spain. Like, this was, you know, still a period with different kingdoms like Castile and Aragon, but it was becoming more nation-like. It was becoming more unified at this time. And you know, so he had this education. He had left after 2 years, but it was sort of very vocational and focused on, you know, just the letter of the law and being a bureaucrat in this expanding imperial system. Whereas, and I contrast that with the education that theologians at Salamanca received, which was a much more humanistic education. And, you know, and I think it's very interesting in the different courses, like, many of the friars who had a more sympathetic perspective on native peoples of Mesoamerica had this fuller, what I would see as a fuller education in you know, humanistic disciplines. Guerrero, though, is a fascinating figure in having this sympathetic perspective to the point of basically marrying into a Maya community. He and another Spaniard, Francisco de Aguilar, were marooned on the Yucatan Peninsula. And whereas Aguilar maintained his Spanish identity and thought he was, say, living among heathens, Guerrero adapted to life among the Maya and married a Maya princess of, you know, a particular kingdom, and had children. So that's probably, you know, what could be considered the first mestizos or mixed race, at least between European and indigenous ancestry in Mesoamerica. And when Cortés shows up and hears that, you know, that there have been these maroon Spaniards, he wants to call for them as they could provide information, logistical information. And Aguilar comes to Cortés and is a key component in the translation. So he can speak Yucatec Maya, which eventually gets translated into Nahuatl by Malinche, which will allow Cortez to speak with Moctezuma or other Aztecs. So Aguilar then takes on this key early role in the translation. Eventually, Malinche, basically picks up enough Castilian to be doing much of the translating herself, whereas Guerrero stays behind and, in fact, apparently even fights in the skirmish against the Spaniards. And so he completely changed his identity. And so this is a fascinating figure as we sort of revisit this episode of 500 years ago and how nuanced and complex people's different strategies were.
Just a quick follow-up on Guerrero. Are there enough sources to reconstruct his figure, or it is kind of an elusive figure in the narratives?
You mean what he looked like physically?
His historical, like all the things he did when he died, etc., or it's an elusive figure, as many in this time?
Yeah, well, some of the accounts say that he had his earlobes perforated. So he wore ear spools, like the classic Mesoamerican, and that he was scarred. So he must have had some sort of scarification, bodily scarification, that the Maya practiced. And so we know those details from, well, historical accounts of the period. But not much more than that. Although we do, I think his wife's name was Zazilha, I believe. I have it written somewhere. But so we know a little bit about, that union. I've never seen it in person, but I know that there's a monument in the Yucatan that is supposed to be depicting the couple and their children as sort of the primer mestizaje.
Sí. Well, you were already introducing La Malinche, and I'm well aware we are leaving several important characters out of this conversation, but I would like to talk for you to introduce to the listeners La Malinche and her significance. Maybe if we can mix this with indigenous alliances with Spanish conquistadors at the time.
Yeah, so La Malinche was born in a sort of frontier area between the southeasternmost extent of the Aztec Empire, which was, Nahuatl speaking, and then the Maya world, especially the Chontal Maya of areas around Laguna de Terminos, which is, in the southern Gulf of Mexico. And those were communities that there was an active trade in from the Caribbean into the Gulf of Mexico using canoes. In fact, in one of his letters, Columbus remarks on these as he's sailing around in the area. You can see these large trading canoes. And so they went back and forth. Some listeners maybe have visited the site of Tulum, a Maya site in the Caribbean and the northeastern Yucatan Peninsula. That was active at this period, and it was part of a trade that would be going around the peninsula from what is today Belize and into Mexico and into the Gulf region. So traders there then had to, by nature, be at least bilingual or multilingual, Malinche was part of that, and she was sold by her family into servitude, and then ends up in this area around Laguna de Terminos when the Cortez expedition comes through, and after fighting with Maya community, eventually, agree to a peace treaty that involves the gifting of women by the Maya to the Spaniards. And this, is a common Mesoamerican political strategy of trying to, both appease and to create bonds between two groups and, sort of after a conflict in particular. And so Malinche then becomes part of the Cortez expedition, and Cortez then, she's treated as property. She was already sold into servitude in her pre-Hispanic indigenous world, and then now to these foreigners again. Cortez gifts her to someone on the expedition who outranked him in the world of Extremadura, And so that indicates to historians that, you know, that he valued Malinche and was then, you know, she was regifted. And then as the expedition is progressing towards Veracruz and into the Gulf, it becomes apparent that Malinche can speak Nahuatl and can translate between Mayan and Nahuatl. And this is a fascinating little chapter in that, here's a woman who is living in her own, structures of oppression in many different ways, but then can take agency for herself and take an active role and reshape not just her own plight, but global history in this way, where, you know, she becomes a key translator and eventually a concubine to Cortez and has a son with him, Martin, who's known as El Mestizo, who was, by some accounts, Cortez's favorite son. And so it's, you know, such a fascinating layer of history and thinking of different motivations of the people, of the characters involved.
And then in the chapter Old Foes, New Allies, you have a section titled Over Mountains and Causeways. And in there, you talk a little bit about Iztapalapa, and I'm going to allow this space to ask you about it. I must confess, I was born and raised in Iztapalapa, so it was really, really exciting to read about this. Can you talk about the significance of Iztapalapa or what role it plays in this story?
Yeah, well, so as you well know, Iztapalapa is a peninsula that juts out, well, formerly jutted out into the lake system in the Basin of Mexico. And so you know, the Basin of Mexico is the broader hydrological region where Mexico City is now dominates as the major metropolitan zone. But it formerly had five different interconnected lakes that from north to south went from being saltier in the north, like Lake Zumpango, to freshwater lakes like Chalco y Xochimilco. And these are areas today, you know, you can still go as a tourist to Xochimilco, as many do, especially on Sundays, and go out on these boats with mariachis and having food and drink. It's a very environment. But there are also, you know, very importantly, there was the system of raised fields known as chinampas, which was a form of wetland reclamation that was really an ingenious agricultural system by the Aztecs, because up in the high, cool Basin of Mexico, which is about a mile and a half above sea level, just as a sidebar, often, you know, when I say to people in Boston that I'm going to Mexico for the summer, people will say, oh, I'm sure it's going to be really hot. But in actuality, it's usually cooler, as you know, than like summers in the northeastern U.S., which are very humid. So you have this dry, cool climate, gets into the 80s and it's sunny, but then it will drop down into the, say, 50s at night. And so because of that mountainous climate, there is the issue of frosts affecting crops. And not just that, Central Mexico also has a very seasonal rain pattern. And so these are two challenges that farmers faced, indigenous farmers in the area. And so the chinampas then were this really ingenious solution to it, because they kept permanently irrigated. There was always a water source. And being by the lake bed, they were always slightly warmer than the mainland, and so they wouldn't face these crops. And so because of that, communities like Iztapalapa and Chalco and Xochimilco were very prosperous Aztec city-states of the time. And so this then becomes really the entry point. There are two dramatic, I think, entry points into the Aztec core. One must have been when, after the massacre at Cholula, the expedition, which now included Tlaxcalteca as, you know, this huge fighting force of native allies, went over what is now known as the Paso de Cortez, which is the mountain pass between the two huge volcanoes, Popocatépetl and Iztaccíhuatl, which are, you know, up around 17,000 feet above sea level and snow-capped year-round. And so that first vantage of coming down from the mountains and seeing Tenochtitlan and the other Aztec cities around the lake must have been very impressive from a distance. Then after staying in Iztapalapa and being, you know, greeted by emissaries from lots of Altepeme, which is the plural of Altepetl, or the city-states in that area, there's a dramatic walk up one of the causeways, the Iztapalapa causeway, into Tenochtitlan. And that's where we have, so the chronicler Bernal Diaz de Castillo, who has, you know, one of the fullest accounts of the conquest, mentions that, you know, gazing at the cities around the lake reminded us of Amadis of Gaul, which was like sort of this chivalric novel of its day, you know, gives you an idea of this conquest force of scrappy soldiers who sort of were linking themselves to this tradition of knights of yore. And even says that, you know, we even thought it could be a dream. So they really were impressed by the urban landscape from Iztapalapa into Tenochtitlan.
Very nice to hear about that. And as I warned before, I could read another epigraph, and I'm going to read the one you used to open the chapter where you explain the Spanish Mexica War. "Nothing but flowers and songs of sorrow are left in Mexico and Tlatelolco, where once we saw warriors and wise men." This chapter is rich in detail about the war, resistance, and siege. But I just wanted to read that epigraph and stop for a moment before all of that war happened and the siege and the sorrow, and ask you to explain the significance of Tenochtitlan and see if you can tell us how it looked like before that moment of war.
Yeah, Tenochtitlan was the largest city in the Western Hemisphere at that time, and would have been more populous than any place in Spain. The population of Tenochtitlan's estimates vary. A very low estimate would be, you know, under around 100,000 or so, up to some that go up to 300,000. But most people sort of situate themselves somewhere around 150 to 200,000 individuals in Tenochtitlan. That would have been larger than any place in Spain. Sevilla was about 90,000 or so. And really in Europe, it was bigger than London. Paris might have been the only here within Europe. So it was an incredibly populous city. And this actually was true for a lot of Mesoamerican history. Mesoamericans tended to develop very large cities. And you can ask why exactly that was. One possible functional explanation is the lack of pack animals meant that, you know, nucleating people for market exchange was beneficial economically, that, you know, you had this sort of these really big hub cities that then were linked by different trade routes through the countryside. And so, some sort of mix of, you know, that economic rationale plus the breadbasket of the Aztec Empire, which were those chinampas I mentioned to the south, really had a population boom in the Aztec period. And so Tenochtitlan was the crown jewel of the cities in the Aztec core. It was arranged on a grid pattern with both the causeways and chinampas forming, you know, this lattice work of passages. So there would be canoes all throughout the lakes coming into the city. Now, I should say that the Tenochtitlan was one of two cities on the same island. And so its sister city was Tlatelolco. And that the epigraph you read was from the Florentine Codex Book 12, which was written largely by scribes who were Tlatelolca. And so these were Mexica ethnically, but they identified as this city-state, Tlatelolco, which was to the north of the island and then annexed by Tenochtitlan. And so because of that, they always have a skepticism towards the Tenochtitlan. You can read a lot of that in Book 12 of the Florentine Codex. Like they're the ones who often portray Moctezuma as cowardly. He wasn't their speaker. He was, and they portray their own speaker as more valiant. And so there's some of that interesting bias in native sources based on city-state. But we now know a lot more about Tenochtitlan, and this is one place where archaeology is really leading the way. We of course have these accounts, these written textual accounts, but ever since the 1970s, especially starting with the project at Templo Mayor, run by Eduardo Matos Moctezuma, now it's directed by Leonardo Lopez Luján. That is the main temple of Tenochtitlan, the double temple that was associated with two gods, Huitzilopochtli, which was a patron god of the Mexica, associated with warfare and the sun, and then Tlaloc, who is the water fertility god in this double temple. There's been extensive work and fascinating finds continue to come out of the Templo Mayor project. There's also the Proyecto Arqueológico Urbano, or PAU, and that project is involves different excavations around the Zócalo and other areas of the Centro Histórico of Mexico, where, you know, in an opportunistic way of salvage archaeology, new buildings from the sacred precinct and even outside of the sacred precinct of Tenochtitlan have come to light. And that includes new finds, including one that horrified the Spaniards, which was the Tzompantli, or the skull rack. And the skull rack, of course, was where, after usually these prisoners of war or captives in battle had been sacrificed at Templo Mayor, their severed heads would be placed on the skull rack. This, of course, is very foreign to us, but you have to remember that, you know, heads were displayed outside the Tower of London at the same time. But this was a huge scale. The Tzompantli now has proven to be very large, corroborating some of the textual accounts. And so, you know, I think the Spaniards were wowed by this city. They talk about Tlatelolco's marketplace as being larger than any they had seen, except for Constantinople, which, you know, would have been the largest in the Mediterranean world at the time. The orderliness of the city was very impressive to them, the cleanliness. But then there was also this element of sacrifice, like having bloodstained idols in the temples and this Tzompantli that appears to have horrified them, or at least they played that up as they were writing their text to justify the invasion that they undertook.
And in your last chapter, you tell us that an enduring myth of the Spanish invasion of Mesoamerica, or encounter with Mesoamerica, is that the defeat of Tenochtitlan marked a definitive completion of what is known as the conquest of Mexico. Why is that a myth?
Because, yeah, there's this, and this, I'm taking that term myth in particular from authors like Matthew Restall, who wrote a book called The Seven Myths of the Spanish Conquest. And so, and you know, that's the idea of a myth of completion, like that there was, the Spaniards came and they conquered Mexico and basically all by themselves. And this was done in a neat sort of 2-year interval of 1519 to 1521. Where now we know that's not at all the case, that native allies were essential, that this conquest would not have happened the way that it did without the native alliance of both Tlaxcala and also Texcoco, which was the second largest of the Aztec Triple Alliance city-states. Then it continued, and it continued for many decades after 1521. And so it included, you know, Cortez's second in command, Alvarado, and his brothers. Actually, there were a few Alvarado brothers who led the invasion of Guatemala and the Maya region, and then areas to the north, and even as far north as the American Southwest. And so, for instance, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the Coronado expedition and involved a large percentage of native central Mexicans on that as well. And so this stitching together of a greater New Spain, which included, you know, Mesoamerica and into the U.S. Southwest, was a very protracted process. And then it even rippled across the Pacific. So, colonization of the Philippines was really a Mexican endeavor that happened from Acapulco and started the Manila Exchange. And along the route, there are even Mexican introductions. I have colleagues who are working in Guam, and there are elements of Mexican material culture out in these far-flung Pacific islands. And so thinking of that as a long-term, century-long process of creating this new Spain and this hub for a global empire.
And I don't want to end this conversation without talking about the pictures and illustrations that one might find in the book. A lot of the pictures were taken by you, and the illustrations were by Pedro Caguanci Hernandez. What was the process of planning which pictures to include, the illustrations, anything related to them you would like to say?
Being an archaeologist means my focus is material culture. And I always joke that we're a visual people. Like, we need to show you the stuff, because a lot of our arguments come from analyzing space, place, art, material culture in different ways. And so it was clear to me that I would need a lot of images for this. And of course, this is something you always negotiate with your press. But that included having a certain number of color plates that would sort of capture some of the more vivid mural art or paintings and certain cities that are in the color plates. So I did really want to illustrate this point of palimpsest history in places, the fact that there are these layers of deep history in many of the different sites that I'm discussing and obviously visited and read that history myself in terms of being there and thinking about place and layers of history. But then also the stuff, the artifacts, the material culture. I'm fascinated by the early colonial period and what is called syncretismo or syncretism, the blending of elements. Archaeologists and historians use a lot of terms for this, including ones like hybrid, that there could be, hybrid material culture. But something that really came out of doing this particular book was thinking of hybridity as like the nature of human existence, that we're always building on what came before us. And so I have one image that is one of the first churches in Tlaxcala. And if you look at the roof, it's this wooden roof that is completely Islamic. It is like a mudéjar roof, and there's other examples like in Cholula, arch colonnade, which really looks like the mosque at Cordoba. So of course, the Spaniards are bringing this mudéjar, which is a hybrid style, to Mexico, which had its own hybridity, right? So one of the plates is from the wonderful site of Cacaxtla, which is in Tlaxcala, which is shows this mix between very central Mexican motifs and gods, like the feathered serpent and the storm god, and very Maya-like artistic elements in this hybrid painting. And really the history of these two places, and I would say even of humanity as a whole, is this continual mixing of historical precedents. And one that I also do in the last chapter, the epigraph for that one I chose very purposefully because it is written by a mestizo Tlaxcalan named Diego Muñoz Camargo, who wrote his own account in the 16th century of the history of his native Tlaxcala and broader Mexico, and even got on a boat and brought it to Spain to present to Felipe II, who was then the king of Spain. And what I love about this is he's invoking the Pillars of Hercules. And the Pillars of Hercules start the narrative of the deep history of Iberia as well, because that was the point around what is Gibraltar and its counterpart in North Africa, that comes from Greco-Roman lore of these areas. This area that was seen as pretty much the end of the world. And so Hercules, within this Greco-Roman tradition, was supposed to have put a sign that said, no further, non plus ultra. And then Carlos V, the emperor, took plus ultra as his motto, that we sailed farther beyond these pillars of Hercules. And what I love about Munoz Camargo is here's someone who is mestizo, who is drawing on, you know, the indigenous history of Tlaxcala, but then framing it within this you know, broader historical narrative of plus ultra and a transatlantic endeavor. And he's educated now in those same Greco-Roman narratives from the Mediterranean.
And David, I know writing a book is a major effort, but is there any other book inside or is any other project you are working on right now that you would like to share?
Well, I mean, I'm primarily, you know, continuing to work in Teotihuacan, and you know, I'm fascinated by really just normal life. What you know, so Teotihuacan is you know, by some accounts the most visited archaeological site in the Americas. It gets between 3 to 5 million visitors a year, and they go primarily, of course, to the pyramids. They go on the famous Avenue of the Dead, and they see the Sun and Moon Pyramid and Feathered Serpent Pyramid. But I've been, since 2012, I've been looking at just quotidian life, daily life, in the southern periphery of the city in a district called Tlahinga. And this is not part of the protected tourist zone. So it involves really close collaboration with the community. And I really enjoy that, working with the community of San Pedro Tlahinga and others around there jointly looking at this history of just daily life on the urban fringe of what was then the largest city of the ancient world, of the ancient Americas, and, you know, collaborating with them on, you know, where to dig next and how to look at household organization and neighborhood organization. What sort of parallels are there for them at present of being sort of on the periphery now of Mexico City, another mega city. And so that's been really fulfilling. We're working on publications both on the sort of academic side of what was life like there and then also with the community partnerships we've formed there.
David, I want to thank you for being on the show today talking about Collision of Worlds, a deep history of the fall of Aztec Mexico and the forging of New Spain. It was a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Pamela. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Until next time, hasta pronto.